You're also going to talk today about some of the research going on. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Do you know, my colleagues here, archaeologist Alan Harn and Mike Connor, both have been working on issues that are particularly interesting. Harn has been the curator of anthropology here for 50 years. He has just published a monograph called Emoquan 600 Generations, and he looks at human history in the Illinois River floodplain here at the doorstep of Dixon Mounds in the Emoquan, the restored Emoquan wetlands. The next project he's working on is writing up the Dixon Mounds excavations. Prior to the construction of this building, there was a good bit of archaeological work that was done, much not yet reported, and Alan is writing that monograph now. It will be a very important contribution to academic archaeology. Connor is excavating with colleagues at Michigan State University at a nearby site called the Morton Site. We're terribly interested in this because it represents a time in prehistory where there seems to be some profound change. 1,100 years ago, the Dixon Mound Cemetery is in use. A nearby site, Larson, is the major village site. When we look at the remains at Dixon Mounds, we see some evidence of violence, but not profound. Not unexpected. These are urban societies. There are going to be tensions, etc. About 200 years later, about two centuries later, we see through another cemetery excavated in the mid-80s evidence of profound violence. And this has intrigued us and made us wonder about what was happening. So Connor has picked a site, the Morton site, which is a village occupied at this time. In fact, at both times, about 900 years ago and about 700 years ago. And he and his colleagues are excavating into this village to try to figure out what's happening in society at that time. It's exciting research. There are a few places in the country that have this story to tell. We are fortunate to have it nearby the museum and have the means to conduct the research.
Well, what do you see at a site that indicates violence?
In the main, there are two pieces of evidence. First and foremost is that you find human remains, the remains of people who have suffered violence. It can be manifest in a variety of ways. We see, for example, arrow points that are clearly lodged in a person, and other evidences, broken bones, and so on. The other is more of a proxy evidence, and it turns out that about 900 years ago, when people begin to move into these large towns, they're building log walls around them. So they're stockaded, they're fortified. And in some cases, the walls are not simply straight curtains of logs, upright logs, but they have bastions, these projections that are built out of the wall, which give people particularly clear view, not only down the wall, but a field of view surrounding the area. In military terms, a bastion gives you a much broader field of fire so that someone can't get right up to the wall and cause difficulties. So those clearly speak to the evidently the stresses of the time, that if one has to erect a substantial wall, which not only requires a great bit of material, but the labor must have been extraordinary, this speaks of societies that there are some challenges that they're trying to address. So those two lines of evidence have given us some pretty clear sense that whatever's happening, and for whatever reasons, those are the things we hope to discover, it's clearly happening here.
Do you have a sense of what the reasons might have been, or is that really yet to be determined?
You know, we have guesses. Good scientists always have guesses, and what you try to do is sort of winnow out the evidence to see which guess is better supported. Our initial notion was that there are people moving into the area who are not local, that there's an indigenous population, a local population, and then another group arrives here, and this is what causes the trouble. Connor and O'Gorman's work now suggests that there may be a period of time in which there's a peaceful coexistence. And then the question becomes, well, what's the catalyst that causes either a dissension among those groups, or maybe there's a third party as yet unidentified? So we're at the point, we're at the great point in science when we know just enough to ask the next question. And we've got pieces of answers, but they are so disarticulated, hard to know how they fit together yet. So this is what keeps us going. A discovery imparts a new question. We go to try to answer it. It gives us another sense. And so after 3 or 4 years of excavation now, we've got some tantalizing information. We know about these two groups. There's some suggestion about peaceful coexistence, and then it begs the question, well, if they're not fighting, then who is?
Did those groups remain in this area by and large? Did they not travel around at all?
Do you know, I think the latter group certainly is traveling. We think their homeland is farther to the north and west. One of the things that we find very interesting is that by about 1400 years AD, we have relatively little evidence of people in this river valley. It appears to be empty, but I say that almost in quotations because there are many things we just don't know. But it is curious that we have these cultural traditions that we can trace well back into time, and they come right up to the 1400s, mid-1400s, something like that. And then we don't have a clear understanding of where people are, why they've abandoned this area, where they went. They just didn't disappear. They're relocating someplace. And then, of course, it begs those even more powerful questions about why. Why are people leaving an area which has the natural capacity to feed so many people? Why would someone leave, in a sense, a lush environment to move to another area?
After all these years, all the research that's been done, it seems like there are still a lot of unanswered questions. Are you surprised by that?
Well, you'd always like to learn faster. But the thing about archaeology is this is a patient person's game. And I would tell you, if we compared notes with what my predecessors knew 100 years ago and look at what we know now, it is leaps and bounds above what they knew. I can only imagine what the next 50 years will bring. And my guess is if they continue to travel at the pace of the acquisition of knowledge and understanding that we have, it will be remarkable what we know. In the meantime, as I say, we know enough to ask a question now. And there are parts of prehistory that we have a pretty clear understanding of, but it's a sketch. And it's really what keeps us up at night wondering. And then tomorrow morning, it's what keeps us plugging away to try to learn more. So I am delighted with how far we've come, but it is humbling to realize how much there is to learn.
How many researchers do you have on staff here?
There are four of us, but we wear different hats. There are two people here who are curators of anthropology. Their responsibilities are collections, research, and then taking that research and building educational materials. So, if you will, we explore sites, we gather objects which become part of the collection, we research those collections, then we build exhibits with what we know. Another one of our researchers is really our exhibits preparator, who has academic interests of his own. And though I would tell you that I spend most of my days now making sure the museum goes forward from an administrative perspective, I delight in sneaking out periodically and doing what I think I do best, which is to explore the past. So that, all told, four of us who spend every moment we can thinking about these problems.
Is there one particular question you would like to see answered next?
Oh, boy. Well, there are many big questions in anthropology broadly. Do you know, I think one which is probably has most of our attention. If you look at human history, something like 99.7% of our existence, we were hunters and gatherers. We relied completely on what nature would provide. That last 0.3% turns out to be the time at which we produce food. We're agriculturalists. And I think we would be enormously well served to understand how humanity made that transition. It occurs at many different places around the world, including here. And One of the great things about the Illinois River Valley and the uplands that surround it is that it's a fabulous archaeological laboratory. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of sites, and the answers to these big questions, which people around the world are trying to understand. Why is it that people begin to recognize the power of plants, to plant seeds and to cultivate them? We may well have insight into that kind of answer here. So if someone walked in 10 minutes and said to me, we've got a good idea of the circumstances under which plant cultivation is invented, I think that'd be a pretty good day's work.
Did plant cultivation come about around the world at around the same time?
No, plant cultivation, it turns out, is highly variable in timing. In the Middle East, maybe 10,000 years ago, we begin to see species like wheat being domesticated. In this river valley, there's some evidence of squashes that are being cultivated maybe 7,000 years ago. But the real revolution of cultivation is a bit later, about 4,000 years ago. By 4,000 years ago, there are a variety of species of plants in this area that people are cultivating, plants that you and I can find on the landscape today, which drew enough attention that they began to manipulate them. They'd collect seeds, they'd build gardens, they'd cultivate them, they'd harvest, they'd keep seed stock, they'd eat some food during the winters. So it's relatively later here that whatever the circumstances are that encourage that kind of invention occur. In other parts of the world, it never happens, and food production is brought to people as a technique of survival. But if you look at Africa, you look at Asia, you look at North America, in South America, the Middle America in particular, that's where you see maize. South America, we see the cultivation of tomatoes, potatoes, varieties of beans, peppers, and so on. Those are really, if you will, the hearths of domestication. But the timing is different. The big question becomes, are the circumstances comparable? So it may occur at a different time, but it may be that the factors that drive it are the same. They just happen to reach that crescendo at different times in human history at different places.
Anything you want to add about the research?
It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Likewise. Thanks.